Welcome to The Locked Room. Stories from the golden age of mystery and crime fiction. I'm Mardell, and our story this week is The Case of the Missing Hand by Arthur Morrison. I think I have recorded in another place Hewitt's frequent aphorism that there is nothing in this world that is at all possible that has not happened or is not happening in London. But there are many strange happenings in this matter-of-fact country, and in these matter-of-fact times that occur far enough from London. Fantastic crimes, savage revenges, medieval superstitions, horrible cruelty, though less in sight, have been no more extinguished by the advent of the 19th century than have the ancient races who practiced them in the Dark Ages. Some of the races have become civilized, and some of the savageries are heard of no more. But there are survivals in both cases. I say these things having in my mind a particular case that came under the personal notice of both Hewitt and myself, an affair that brought one upstanding with a gasp and a doubt of one's error. My good uncle, the Colonel, was not in the habit of gathering large house parties at his place at Ratherby, partly because the place was not a great one and partly because the Colonel's gout was. But there was an excellent bit of shooting for two or three guns, and even when he was unable to leave the house himself, my uncle was always pleased if some good friend were enjoying a good day's sport in his territory. As to myself, the good old soul was in a perpetual state of offense because I visited him so seldom, though whenever my scant holidays fell in a convenient time of the year, I was never insensible to the attractions of the Ratherby stubble. More than once I had sat by the old gentleman when his foot was exceptionally troublesome, amusing him with accounts of some of the doings of Martin Hewitt. And more than once had my uncle expressed his desire to meet Hewitt himself, and commissioned me with an invitation to be presented to Hewitt at the first likely opportunity for a joint excursion to Ratherby. At length, I persuaded Hewitt to take a fortnight's rest, coincident with a little vacation of my own, and we got down to Ratherby within a few days past September the 1st. And before a gun had been fired at the Colonel's bit of shooting, the Colonel himself we found confined to the house, with his foot on the familiar rest. And though ourselves were the only guests, we managed to do pretty well together. It was during this short holiday that the case I have mentioned arose. When I first began to record some of the more interesting of Hewitt's operations, I think I explained that such cases as I myself had not witnessed, I should set down in impersonal narrative form without intruding myself. The present case, so far as Hewitt's work was concerned, I saw. But there were circumstances which led up to it that we only fully learned afterwards. These circumstances, however, I shall put in their proper place at the beginning. The Fosters were a fairly old Ratherby family, of whom Mr. John Foster had died by an accident at the age of about 40, leaving a wife 12 years younger than himself, and three children, two boys and one girl, who was the youngest. The boys grew up strong, healthy, out-of-door young ruffians, with all the tastes of sportsmen, and all the qualities, good and bad, natural to lads of fairly well-disposed character, allowed a great deal too much of their own way from the beginning. Their only real bad quality was an unfortunate knack of bearing malice and a certain savage vindictiveness towards such persons as they chose to consider their enemies. With the louts of the village they were at unceasing war, and indeed once got into serious trouble for peppering the butcher's son, who certainly was a great blackguard, with sparrow shot. At the usual time, they went to Oxford together, and were fraternally sent down together in their second year, after enjoying a spell of rustication in their first. The offense was never specifically mentioned about Ratherby, but was rumored of as something particularly outrageous. It was at this time, 16 years or thereabout after the death of their father, that Henry and Robert Foster first saw and disliked Mr. Jonas Sneathy, a director of penny banks and small insurance offices. He visited Ranworth, the Fosters' home, a great deal more than the brothers thought necessary, and indeed it was not for lack of rudeness on their part that Mr. Sneathy failed to understand, as far as they were concerned, his room was preferred to his company. But their mother welcomed him, and in the end it was announced that Mrs. Foster was to marry again, and that after her name would be Mrs. Sneathy. Hereupon there were violent scenes at Ranworth. Henry and Robert Foster denounced their prospective father-in-law as a fortune hunter, a snuffler, a hypocrite. They did not stop at broad hints as to the honesty of his penny banks and insurance offices, and the house straightway became a house of bitter strife. The marriage took place, and it was not long before Mr. Sneathy's real character became generally obvious. For months, he was a model, if somewhat sanctimonious, husband, and his influence over his wife was complete. Then he discovered that her property had been strictly secured by her first husband's will, and that willing as she might be, she was unable to raise money for her new husband's benefit, and was quite powerless to pass to him any of her property by deed of gift. Hereupon the man's nature showed itself. Foolish woman, as Mrs. Sneathy might be, she was a loving, indeed an infatuated wife, but Sneathy repaid her devotion by vulgar derision, never hesitating to state plainly that he had married her for his own profit, and that he considered himself swindled in the result. More, he even proceeded to blows and other practical brutality of a sort, only devisable by a mean and ugly nature. This treatment, at first secret, became open, and in the midst of it Mr. Sneathy's penny banks and insurance offices came to a grievous smash all at once, and everybody wondered how Mr. Sneathy kept out of gaol. Keep out of gaol he did, however, for he had taken care to remain on the safe side of the law, though some of his co-directors learned the taste of penal servitude. But he was beggared and lived, as it were, a mere pensioner in his wife's house. Here his brutality increased to a frightful extent, till his wife, already broken in health in consequence, went in constant fear of her life, and Miss Foster passed a life of weeping misery. All her friends' entreaties, however, could not persuade Mrs. Sneathy to obtain a legal separation from her husband. She clung to him with the excuse, for it was no more, that she hoped to win him to kindness by submission, and with a pathetic infatuation that seemed to increase as her bodily strength diminished. Henry and Robert, as may be supposed, were anything but silent in these circumstances. Indeed, they broke out violently again and again, and more than once went near permanently injuring their worthy father-in-law, once especially when Sneathy, absolutely without provocation, made a motion to strike his wife in their presence. There was a fearful scene. The two sprang at him like wild beasts, knocked him down, and dragged him to the balcony with the intention of throwing him out of the window. But Mrs. Sneathy impeded them, hysterically imploring them to desist. "If you lift your hand, my mother, roared Henry, gripping Sneathy by the throat till his fat face turned blue and banging his head against the wall. "If you lift your hand to my mother again, I'll chop it off. I will. I'll chop it off and drive it down your throat." "We'll do worse," said Robert, white and frantic with passion. "We'll hang you. Hang you to the door. You are a proved liar and a thief, and you're worse than a common murderer. I'd hang you to the front door for twopence." For a few days, Sneathy was comparatively quiet, cowed by their violence. Then he took to venting redoubled spite on his unfortunate wife. Always, in the absence of her sons, well aware that she would never inform them. On their part, finding him apparently better behaved in consequence of their attack, they thought to maintain his wholesome terror, and scarcely passed him without a menace, taking a fiendish delight in repeating the threats they had used during the scene by way of keeping it present to his mind. "Take care of your hands, sir," they would say. "Keep them to yourself, or by George, we'll take them off with a billhook." But his revenge for all this, Sneathy took unobserved on their mother. Truly, a miserable household. Soon, however, the brothers left home and went to London by way of looking for a profession. Henry began a belated study of medicine, and Robert made a pretense of reading for the bar. Indeed, their departure was, as much as anything, a consequence of the earnest entreaty of their sister, who saw that their presence at home was an exasperation to Sneathy and aggravated her mother's secret sufferings. They went, therefore, but at Ranworth, things became worse. Little was allowed to be known outside the house, but it was broadly said that Mr. Sneathy's behavior had now become outrageous beyond description. Servants left faster than new ones could be found, and gave their late employer the character of a raving maniac. Once, indeed, he committed himself in the village, attacking with his walking stick an inoffensive tradesman who had accidentally brushed against him, and immediately running home. This assault had to be compounded for by a payment of £50. And then Henry and Robert Foster received a most urgent letter from their sister, requesting their immediate presence at home. They went at once, of course, and the servant's account of what occurred was this. When the brothers arrived, Mr. Sneathy had just left the house. The brothers were shut up with their mother and sister for about a quarter of an hour, and then left them and came out to the stable yard together. The coachman, he was a new man who had only arrived the day before, overheard a little of their talk as they stood by the door. Mr. Henry said that the thing must be done and at once. There are two of us, so that it ought to be easy enough. And afterwards Mr. Roberts said, "You'll know best how to go about it as a doctor," after which Mr. Henry came towards the coachman and asked in what direction Mr. Sneathy had gone. The coachman replied that it was in the direction of Ratherby Wood, by the winding footpath that led through it. But as he spoke, he distinctly, with the corner of his eye, saw the other brother take a halter from a hook by the stable door and put it into his coat pocket. So far for the earlier events, whereof I learned later, bit by bit. It was on the day of the arrival of the brothers Foster at their old home, and indeed little more than 2 hours after the incident last set down, that news of Mr. Sneathy came to Colonel Brett's place, where Hewitt and I were sitting and chatting with the colonel. The news was that Mr. Sneathy had committed suicide, had been found hanging, in fact, to a tree in Ratherby Wood, just by the side of the footpath. Hewitt and I had, of course, at this time, never heard of Sneathy, and the colonel told us what little he knew. He had never spoken to the man, he said. Indeed, nobody in the place outside Ranworth would have anything to do with him. "He's certainly been an unholy scoundrel over those poor people's banks," said my uncle, And if what they say is true, he's been about as bad as possible to his wretched wife. He must have been pretty miserable, too, with all his scoundrelism. Or he was a completely ruined man without a chance of retrieving his position, and detested by everybody. Indeed, some of his recent doings, of what I have heard is to be relied on, have been very much those of a madman, so that on the whole I'm not much surprised. Suicide's about the only crime, I suppose, that he has never experimented with till now, and indeed, it's rather a service to the world at large. His only service, I expect. The colonel sent a man to make further inquiries, and presently this man returned with the news that now it was said that Mr. Sneathy had not committed suicide, but had been murdered. And hard on the man's heels came Mr. Hardwick, a neighbor of my uncle's and a fellow J.P. He had had the case reported to him, it seemed, as soon as the body had been found, and had at once gone to the spot. He had found the body hanging, and with the right hand cut off. "It's a murder, Brett," he said, "without doubt. A most horrible case of murder and mutilation. The hand is cut off and taken away, but whether the atrocity was committed before or after the hanging, of course, I can't say. But the missing hand makes it plainly a case of murder and not a suicide. I've come to consult you about issuing a warrant, for I think there's no doubt as to the identity of the murderers." "That's a good job," said the colonel, "else we should have had some work for Mr. Martin Hewitt here, which wouldn't be fair, as he's taking a rest. Whom do you think of having arrested?" "The two young Fosters, it's plain as it can be, and a most revolting crime, too, bad as Sneathy may have been. They came down from London today and went out deliberately to it, it's clear. They were heard talking of it, asked as to the direction in which he had gone, and followed him, and with a rope." "Isn't that a rather unusual form of murder, hanging?" Hewitt remarked. "Perhaps it is," Mr. Hardwick replied, "but it's the case here plain enough. It seems, in fact, that they had a way of threatening to hang him and even to cut off his hand if he used it to strike their mother, so that they have appeared to carry out what might have seemed mere idle threats in a diabolically savage way. Of course, they may have strangled him first and hanged him after by way of carrying out their threat and venting their spite on the mutilated body, but that they did it is plain enough for me. I've spent an hour or two over it, and I feel I am certainly more than justified in ordering their apprehension. Indeed, they were with him at the time, as I have found their tracks on the footpath through the wood." The colonel turned to Martin Hewitt. "Mr. Hardwick, you must know," he said, "is by way of being an amateur in your particular line, and a very good amateur, too, I should say, judging by a case or two I have known in this county." Hewitt bowed and laughingly expressed a fear lest Mr. Hardwick should come to London and supplant him altogether. "This seems a curious case," he added. "If you don't mind, I think I should like to take a glance at the tracks and whatever other traces there may be, just by way of keeping my hand in." "Certainly," Mr. Hardwick replied, brightening. "I should of all things like to have Mr. Hewitt's opinions on the observations I have made, just for my own gratification. As to his opinion, there can be no room for doubt. The thing is plain." With many promises not to be late for dinner, we left my uncle and walked with Mr. Hardwick in the direction of Ratherby Wood. It was an unfrequented part, he told us, and by particular care he had managed, he hoped, to prevent the rumors spreading to the village yet, so that we might hope to find the trails not yet overlaid. It was a man of his own, he said, who, making a short cut through the wood, had come upon the body hanging and had run immediately to inform him. With this man he had gone back, cut down the body, and made his observations. He had followed the trail backward to Ranworth, and there had found the new coachman, who had once been in his own service. From him he had learned the doings of the brothers Foster as they left the place, and from him he had ascertained that they had not then returned. Then, leaving his man by the body, he had come straight to my uncle's. Presently we came on the footpath leading from Ranworth across the field to Ratherby Wood. It was a mere trail of bare earth, worn by successive feet amid the grass. It was damp, and we all stooped and examined the footmarks that were to be seen on it. They all pointed one way, towards the wood in the distance.
"Fortunately, it's not a greatly frequented path," Mr. Hardwick said. "You see, there are the marks of three pairs of feet only, and as first Sneathy and then both of the brothers came this way, their footmarks must be theirs. Which are Sneathy's is plain. They are these large flat ones. If you notice, they are all distinctly visible in the center of the track, showing plainly that they belong to the man who walked alone, which was Sneathy. Of the others, the marks of the outside feet, the left on the left side and the right on the right, are often not visible. Clearly, they belong to two men walking side by side, and more often than not, treading with their outer feet on the grass at the side. And where these happen to drop on the same spot as the marks in the middle, they cover him. Plainly, they are the footmarks of Henry and Robert Foster, made as they followed Sneathy. Don't you agree with me, Mr. Hewitt?"
"Oh, yes, that's very plain. You have a better pair of eyes than most people, Mr. Hardwick, and a good idea of using them, too. We will go into the wood now. As a matter of fact, I can pretty clearly distinguish most of the other footmarks, those on the grass, but that's a matter of much training." We followed the footpath, keeping on the grass at its side, in case it should be desirable to refer again to the foot tracks. For some little distance into the wood, the tracks continued as before, those of the brothers overlaying those of Sneathy. Then there was a difference. The path here was broader and muddy because of the proximity of trees. And suddenly the outer footprints separated, and no more overlay the larger ones in the center, but proceeded at an equal distance on either side of them.
"See there," cried Mr. Hardwick, pointing triumphantly to the spot. "This is where they overtook him and walked on either side. The body was found only a little farther on. You could see the place now if the path didn't zigzag about so."
Hewitt said nothing, but stopped and examined the tracks at the sides with great care and evident thought, spanning the distances between them comparatively with his arms. Then he rose and stepped lightly from one mark to another, taking care not to tread on the mark itself. "Very good," he said shortly on finishing his examination. "We'll go on." We went on and presently came to the place where the body lay. Here the ground sloped from the left down towards the right, and a tiny streamlet, a mere trickle of a foot or two wide, ran across the path. In rainy seasons, it was probably wider, for all the earth and clay had been washed away for some feet on each side, leaving flat, bare, and very coarse gravel on which the trail was lost. Just beyond this and to the left, the body lay on a grassy knoll under the limb of a tree, from which still depended a part of the cut rope. It was not a pleasant sight. The man was a soft, fleshy creature, probably rather under than over the medium height, and he lay there with his stretched neck and protruding tongue, a revolting object. His right arm lay by his side, and the stump of the wrist was clotted with black blood. Mr. Hardwick's man was still in charge, seemingly little pleased with his job, and a few yards off,
stood a couple of countrymen looking on. Hewitt asked from which direction these men had come, and having ascertained and noticed their footmarks, he asked them to stay exactly where they were, to avoid confusing such other tracks as might be seen. Then he addressed himself to his examination. "First," he said, glancing up at the branch that was scarce a yard above his head, "this rope has been here for some time." "Yes," Mr. Hardwick replied, "it's an old swing rope. Some children used it in the summer, but it got partly cut away, and the odd couple of yards has been hanging since." Said Hewitt, "then if the Fosters did this, they were saved some trouble by the chance and were able to take their halter back with them, and so avoid one chance of detection." He very closely scrutinized the top of the tree stump, probably the relic of a tree that had been cut down long before, and then addressed himself to the body. "When you cut it down," he said, "did it fall in a heap?"
"No, my man eased it down to some extent."
"Not onto its face?"
"Oh no, onto its back, just as it is now."
Mr. Hardwick saw that Hewitt was looking at muddy marks on each of the corpse's knees, to one of which a small leaf clung, and at one or two other marks of the same sort on the forepart of the dress.
"That seems to show pretty plainly," he said, "that he must have struggled with them and was thrown forward, doesn't it?"
Hewitt did not reply, but gingerly lifted the right arm by its sleeve.
"Is either of the brothers Foster left-handed?" he asked.
"No, I think not. Here, Bennett, you've seen plenty of their doings, cricket, shooting, and so on. Do you remember if either is left-handed?"
"Neither, sir," Mr. Hardwick's man answered. "Both on 'em's right-handed."
Hewitt lifted the lapel of the coat and attentively regarded a small rent in it. The dead man's hat lay near, and after a few glances at that, Hewitt dropped it and turned his attention to the hair. This was coarse and long and dark and brushed straight back with no parting.
"This doesn't look very symmetrical, does it?" Hewitt remarked, pointing to the locks over the right ear.
They were shorter just there than on the other side, and apparently very clumsily cut, whereas in every other part the hair appeared to be rather well and carefully trimmed. Mr. Hardwick said nothing, but fidgeted a little, as though he considered that valuable time was being wasted over irrelevant trivialities. Presently, however, he spoke.
"There's very little to be learned from the body, is there?" he said. "I think I'm quite justified in ordering their arrest, eh? Indeed, I've wasted too much time already."
Hewitt was groping about among some bushes behind the tree from which the corpse had been taken. When he answered, he said,
"I don't think I should do anything of the sort just now, Mr. Hardwick. As a matter of fact, I fancy," this word with an emphasis, "that the brothers Foster may not have seen this man Sneathy today at all."
"Not seen him? Why, my dear sir, there's no question of it. It's certain, absolutely. The evidence is positive. The fact of the threats and of the body being found treated so is pretty well enough, I should think. But that's nothing now. Look at these footmarks. They've walked along with him, one on each side, without a possible doubt. Plainly, they were the last people with him in any case, and you don't mean to ask anybody to believe that the dead man, even if he hanged himself, cut off his own hand first? Even if you do, where's the hand? And, putting aside all these considerations, each a complete case in itself, the Fosters must at least have seen the body as they came past, and yet nothing has been heard of them yet. Why didn't they spread the alarm? They went straight away in the opposite direction from home. There are their footmarks, which you've not seen yet, beyond the gravel."
Hewitt stepped over
to where the patch of clean gravel ceased, at the opposite side to that from which we had approached the brook, and there sure enough were the now familiar footmarks of the brothers leading away from the scene of Sneedy's end.
"Yes," Hewitt said, "I see them."
"Of course, Mr. Hardwick, you'll do what seems right in your own eyes, and in any case, not much harm will be done by the arrest beyond a terrible fright for that unfortunate family. Nevertheless, if you care for my impression, it is as I have said, that the Fosters have not seen Sneedy today."
"But what about the hand?"
"As to that, I have a conjecture, but as yet it is only a conjecture, and if I told you, you would probably call it absurd. Certainly, you'd disregard it, and perhaps quite excusably. The case is a complicated one, and if there is anything at all in my conjecture, one of the most remarkable I have ever had to do with, it interests me intensely, and I shall devote a little time now to following up the theory I have formed. You have, I suppose, already communicated with the police."
"I wired to Shopperton at once, as soon as I heard of the matter. It is a 12 miles drive, but I wonder the police have not arrived yet. They can't be long. I don't know where the village constable has got to, but in any case he wouldn't be much good. But as to your idea that the Fosters can't be suspected—"
"Well, nobody could respect your opinion, Mr. Hewitt, more than myself, but really, just think. The notion's impossible, 50-fold impossible. As soon as the police arrive, I shall have that trail followed and the Fosters apprehended. I should be a fool if I didn't."
"Very well, Mr. Hardwick," Hewitt replied. "You'll do what you consider your duty, of course, and quite properly. Though I would recommend you to take another glance at those three trails in the path. I shall take a look in this direction." And he turned up by the side of the streamlet, keeping on the gravel at its side. I followed.
Join me next week for the conclusion of The Case of the Missing Hand by Arthur Morrison on The Locked Room. In the meantime, beware of footsteps in the dark. Thank you.